This is the Dakota Free Press Podcast. I'm Corey Heidelberger. Thank you for tuning in today. In this episode, we talk to Libby Screen, Policy Director for the American Civil Liberties Union of South Dakota. The American Civil Liberties Union has launched a new campaign in South Dakota called the Smart Justice Campaign. The intent? To raise awareness of criminal justice issues and to encourage South Dakotans and their elected officials to seek smarter alternatives to mass incarceration. My conversation with Libby Screen took place at the ACLUSD headquarters in Sioux Falls on August 10th, 2018. This is Dakota Free Press, and we're with Libby Screen of the American Civil Liberties Union of South Dakota. How are you today, Libby?
I am good. Hanging in there. It's Friday afternoon. Been a busy week, but happy to talk.
And how are things for civil liberties in South Dakota?
Good. We're always trying to hold the line and kind of push things forward a little bit, and we're getting there slowly.
Good. So we've still got them, right?
We've still got them, yes. I can confirm that.
Well, that's a relief. We're here today to talk about the ACLU's new, you're calling it the Smart Justice Campaign, dealing with incarceration and kind of focusing on the role of our attorney general in this. Real quick, before we get into the details, tell me, is this a nationwide campaign or just South Dakota specific?
So the campaign that we're running is South Dakota specific, but we've certainly taken cues from what's going on nationwide. I think nationally we're starting to see a resurgence of a focus on prison reform and mass incarceration and the role that prosecutors and attorneys general have played in mass incarceration. We've found that a lot of people nationwide don't really recognize or understand the role of their local prosecutors or their state attorneys general. They don't realize that in many cases they are elected and therefore that the people are their constituents. Since we have obviously an attorney general's race coming up and we'll vote on that in November 2018, we thought now seemed like a great time to kick things off and start doing some public education and looking into the policies that we think could change in South Dakota.
Sure. Well, and now you mentioned attorney general and public prosecutors, that would be our state's attorneys in South Dakota. And this, you say this is a public education campaign. So tell us, what does the ACLU believe voters need to know when they go to vote for these important positions, our attorneys, our attorney general and our state's attorneys?
Yeah, I think one of the first things when we're talking about the attorney general race is we really want to remind people that the attorney general is an elected official and that they are the attorney general's constituents. Further, I think a lot of people think of the attorney general as just a government lawyer, right? And certainly the attorney general does the lawyer stuff. They represent the state in court. They, you know, write legal briefs and all of that. But they also have an enormous amount of influence in the state legislature, as well as with law enforcement. Our sort of thesis is that the attorney general really sets the culture of incarceration in South Dakota, and that they therefore have a lot of influence both directly and indirectly on the way our system works.
So tell us then, what does the culture of incarceration, as you put it, what does that look like now in South Dakota? And I assume there are some changes you think need to be made. Tell us about what changes you think we need to see in that culture, if that's not too big of a question.
No, I could go on and on about that. I think right now our culture of incarceration in South Dakota is very much a punitive one. You know, we are a state that has mandatory minimums in place. We are the only state that treats the ingestion of drugs or having drugs in your system, in your bloodstream, as a felony.
The only state.
So
it's a crime elsewhere, but just a misdemeanor?
Well, in some states it's not a crime. In some states, okay, There's a similar formulation and it's a misdemeanor. But
that's the ingestion.
That's the ingestion.
Use taking in of the drug.
Yep. And I think that we've really haven't learned the lessons here in South Dakota fully of the failed war on drugs. We're still very much a tough on crime state. And though there have been some reforms, obviously, that have taken place with the adult corrections reform in 2013 and the juvenile justice reforms in 2015, I think that something that we've noticed lately in the last legislative session and even in things like the mayoral race in Sioux Falls, sort of a resurgence of this tough on crime rhetoric. And so with the election and with this sort of resurgence of this rhetoric and this idea that the small reforms we've made are not tough and we need to go back to that way, I think that we're in a period of time that's really dangerous and that could set us down a path going one way or another, either getting even tougher and harsher or recognizing a lot of the criminal justice issues we face are really public health issues and community issues rather than something that can be solved through incarceration.
We'll keep going down that, but you mentioned this kind of resurgence in tough on crime rhetoric, and interesting to mention you see that even in like a municipal race.
Yeah.
Allegedly nonpartisan race here in Sioux Falls, but well, whatever.
Right.
We saw the rhetoric there. Does the ACLU or do you in your capacity have any idea of why that resurgence might be happening?
I really don't know. I think that when the state passed those reforms in 2013 and 2015, to me it seems natural that that was something that those pieces of legislation were going to take a significant amount of time to really start to reap the benefits. And now I think we're at a point where it's a couple years later and people are getting antsy and kind of glomming on to fears that we hear nationwide about the opioid crisis and meth use, things that certainly are issues that should be addressed, but because we don't know what else to do, or maybe even more because we don't want to invest in the things that can actually work, we're going to go for the easy solution of saying, I'm going to lock more people up, and then boom, 6 months later, you can show that you have met your goals, right? Reform, changing the prison system, incarcerating less people, and saving money that way takes years and years. And I think for a lot of politicians, it's that's a hard sell, and that's not something that they can say a year later, I made my campaign promise, I fulfilled it. And I think so in that way, politicians and perhaps voters or criminal justice experts don't exactly match up.
Interesting. So it's short-term gain versus long-term investment.
Mm-hmm.
But I take it you would suggest that, because it sounds like a big focus of this, especially in terms of incarceration. Well, what's the alternative? It sounds like you're going to say the alternative is investing in drug treatment.
Yes.
Taking care of getting people off opioids,
yes.
Off meth, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Well, and if you talk to people in the system, you hear a lot from law enforcement and criminal justice experts. They talk about the criminal justice system or drug treatment as a three-legged stool, right? And you've got prevention, treatment, and enforcement. And in theory, that's great. That could work in harmony. But when we, do this much prevention and this much treatment and this much enforcement. Sorry,
for
I know it's audio.
Home, that's teeny, teeny bits of the first two and a huge bit of the enforcement.
Exactly,
correct?
Exactly. We're putting all of our effort and maybe not all, most of our effort and most of our money into enforcement. And therefore, nobody wants to invest in prevention and treatment when we've already got a bunch of money sunk into prisons and prosecutions and all of that.
So even cost-wise, you're saying that we've spent all the money on jails and we don't have wiggle room left in the budget to do the programs you'd want to do.
Exactly.
What can you nutshell for us? We'll figure out cost later.
Right,
what would good treatment interventions and preventions look like?
I think prevention is the hardest one because we're going all the way back to talk about the big picture. We're talking about prenatal care. We're talking about early childhood education, about functioning education systems so that kids can grow up in a community and feel connected and have the resources that they need.
But functioning education systems, you're not talking drug education. You're talking
the holistic thing. Yeah, yes.
K, kindergarten, just good education,
yeah.
Period.
So our sort of theory of smart justice and the way we've been describing it is a way of addressing criminal justice issues that solves the problems of crime rather than simply punishing people. We want our system to address the profound connections of crime to mental health, addiction, employment, education, and housing. There are so many barriers that people face before they're in the system and after they've gotten out of the system that just make it impossible for a prison system and simply incarcerating people and punishing them to work. There are a lot of ideas that go into that. We've been thinking a lot about the ripple effect, especially when you incarcerate a woman and a woman with children and what happens to her children and her family. I think that we've tried to look at our system or like the laws that we've tried to implement are so specific and don't take into account all of these things. And that's in part why we've ended up where we are.
I'm intrigued by this. It's a really holistic approach, and I can understand why it's maybe harder for politicians to take this route, because you're saying the solution to the problem isn't just put people in jail now, it's making sure really all of our civic institutions, you mentioned a lot there, good education, etc., making sure all of those civic institutions are supporting people and
preventing,
getting
rid of the factors that would lead people down the wrong path
to
drug addiction, among other troubles.
And healthcare access is a big thing, obviously. If you're suffering from addiction and want to kick your addiction or do something about it, and you don't have access to healthcare or to competent medical professionals who can really use evidence-based approaches to help treat your addiction, I mean, when it comes to drugs, we very much still treat them as a moral issue, as though if you're addicted to drugs that you have failed as a person, you are morally, you know, there's something wrong with you. And I think that that's an approach that never has worked and is never going to work. And until we start treating things like drugs and addiction and drug use as the public health problems that they are, we're just going to keep doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result.
Well, and that makes sense, because what you're saying is that moral condemnation that leads to an emphasis on the punitive side, on the enforcement side, and not on the ideas of prevention and treatment, which I can understand from a moral perspective. Some people say, oh, well, that's like giving them something. It's doing something
it's
nice.
It's a handout. Yes, absolutely.
So there's resistance there.
I've always kind of wondered where that came from, and today I was looking at an old
The
idea of the morality, right? I was looking at an old Associated Press study. It was from 2010, so it's a little outdated now, but it was talking about how until 100 years ago, drugs were simply a commodity, and then Western cultural shifts made them immoral and deviant.
Wait, 100 years ago? It's that recent?
Yeah. So this AP study was describing it as religious movements led the crusades against drugs. In 1904, an Episcopal bishop returning from a mission in the Far East argued for banning opium after observing the natives' moral degeneration. In 1914, the New York Times reported that cocaine caused black people to commit violent crimes and made them resistant to police bullets. In the decades that followed, drugs became synonymous with evil.
Given the examples you gave there, there also seems to be sort of a racial overtone to that as well.
Yes.
Because they're responding to perceptions of drug use among the other people who aren't, you know, the typical Western, we'll say, white folks here.
Yeah.
And so all those drugs are bad, because look at those, you said that was from China, or the opioid, or the opium.
The Far East,
right.
Whatever that exactly.
So folks
from
the Far East, and then seeing blacks supposedly using drugs and becoming worse. So, so that would support the idea that kind of our fight against drugs, or the war against drugs, has some origins in kind of racial thinking.
Yeah, and I think that is very much reflected in our current system, both nationwide and in South Dakota. One of the things that we're really interested in is looking at the overrepresentation of people of color within our system, right? So we know that here in South Dakota, demographically, our population as a state is about 9% Native American. Our prison population is about 33% Native American. If you look at the women's prison, it's even worse. I believe the women's prison is about 52% Native American. And I think that one thing, to kind of bring it back to the Attorney General and to prosecutors, is that we want to know why this is happening. And we want an Attorney General who commits openly to saying, yeah, there are people of color are overrepresented in our system, and I'm going to make it as a priority as a candidate and as your future Attorney General to find out why that's happening exactly and to start doing something about it.
Whether it's drugs or whether it's other crime, the fact is our criminal justice system is putting more people of color behind bars than their representation in the population ought to produce.
Absolutely, and I think it's worth noting that there is absolutely no statistics or research or anything that indicates that has anything to do with people of color using drugs or committing crimes at a rate higher than the rest of the population. Every study I've seen has shown that drug use and crime is pretty much equal across demographics, but we're just locking up certain people instead of other people.
And so I guess, well, it makes sense. If there are problems with institutional racism, the more power institutions have to put people in jail, well, that's one more tool institutional racism is going to be expressed.
Yeah.
And that's something we need to fight.
Yeah, absolutely. Or at least acknowledge, right? And I think with all of this work and all of our smart justice vision, we're not necessarily saying, like, we have the answer, and we can give you an exact roadmap of the policies you need to pass to fix the system, right? If we knew how to do that, theoretically at least, we would have already done that. Instead, we're saying we need to take a different approach, and we need to think about things differently than we have in the past, and our leaders in particular need to have a little bit of moral courage and an ability to look at the long-term plan and the strategy instead of going for the easier wins of, you know, locking more people up.
Sure, and there you're right. That makes sense. There is a huge, long-term, mm-hmm. holistic approach that needs to be done.
Yeah.
At peril of undermining that message, I want to go to one of the, I don't know that drug treatment is a short-term solution, but it's certainly, it seems one of the obvious, mm-hmm. immediate kind of policies we can turn to,
yes.
along with ensuring the strength of other institutions. But let's go back and talk a little bit more about the drug treatment side.
Mm-hmm.
What are your numbers say, or what does your research say? What kind of drug treatment do we need to offer?
Mm-hmm.
When do we need to offer it? And how much would that cost compared to the incarceration that we see?
I think it's a complicated question. You know, I don't have the exact figures or a really solid. I can't say it'll cost us X to invest in treatment and Y to keep locking people up. But I think that we have seen in other states and in other jurisdictions, places where they've taken a more proactive approach, whether we're talking about things like Medicaid expansion or just enhancing treatment access. I know, was it here in South Dakota, they recently changed the Medicaid eligibility for addiction treatment. So it's not an expansion of Medicaid, but that's another group of people who previously were not eligible to treatment who can now get that.
They were already on Medicaid. That's
right, but
it's not an expansion.
But they couldn't
saying,
get
this
that
is
treatment.
A benefit you can now get.
Yeah, and I mean, that is something that, of course, will cost some money up front, but I think it's a heck of a lot cheaper than charging someone, arresting them, and incarcerating them for years and years. You know, we know that in South Dakota, on average, it costs about $52 a day to incarcerate a person, and that's the general. If you look at the women's prisons, about $82 a day to lock someone up and keep them in DOC custody. And I think that's part of what's challenging, you know, about what we're proposing or the way we're suggesting people think about it, is that a lot of this stuff, we don't have solid numbers. You know, there are certainly medical professionals and addiction counselors and people who work in that space that can tell you what types of treatment and what types of behavioral modification tends to work. And I think we've seen some of that if you look at the Public Safety Improvement Act reports every year. When you dig into those reports, it shows you how many people were put on what treatment after getting out of prison and how that was working, the behavior modification. And the numbers are pretty encouraging. So I think we definitely have evidence that shows us what the path kind of looks like, but we need people who are in power to take the time to really dig in and figure it out.
Do we have enough drug treatment services available? And even drug treatment professionals. Are we going to need to get more of those as part of this solution?
I can't give you specific numbers, but I think yes. You know, I think especially in more rural parts of South Dakota, healthcare access is hard for drug treatment and mental illness and even OBGYN services. We know that rural areas don't have the staffing or the centers that can actually do the work that needs to be done, and that's a huge undertaking. I mean, I think you probably saw how the Rapid City City Council refused to allow the city to submit a proposal to the Helmsley Trust to look at mental illness in Western South Dakota. That was earlier this week. Their city
just turned down studying?
Studying, yeah. Sending the proposal. The Helmsley Trust, from my understanding from the reports I've read, asked them to submit a proposal so that they could potentially study it, and the city council said no.
Why on earth not?
You'll have to look at the article, but from what I remember, it was, we don't want to make this a county problem, this is the state's problem, and if Pennington County starts to, oh, maybe it was the county commission, not the city council, I might be getting those mixed up. But basically, if we as the county take this on, then the state's gonna use that to justify not giving us more money or addressing the problem in the future, so we don't even want to go down that road.
Interesting.
And it was a 3-2 vote, right? So I think, going all the way around, one of the things that we're also really interested in, that I have become very interested in, is the difference between paying attention to politics on the local level and the national level. National politics are very sexy, they're very interesting, but so much happens locally that can really change people's lives here, and I would suggest that we don't pay enough attention to that.
That takes me down a different road.
I know. I'm going all over.
No, it's all right, but there's so much to this. You mentioned mm-hmm. something interesting there. This, because your campaign, the Smart Justice campaign, is about educating the public.
Mm-hmm.
It's very much focused on South Dakota-specific mm-hmm. offices and issues.
Yeah.
So I would assume part of your campaign has to address exactly what you just said. It's a lot easier for people consuming news, mm-hmm. people paying attention to things, to go get news about whatever the latest national level scandal is.
Mm-hmm.
What do you have in mind as a strategy to break through that and get people's attention mm-hmm. about both the state level issues, the things an attorney general can do, and the things that their own county commission and state's attorneys can do about this,
yeah.
about incarceration and drug treatment?
Right. So I think kind of starting with the attorney general, this is, you know, we've started doing this work in the past few months, and it is definitely, like, our vision of a smart justice campaign is not something that's going to end at the election. We know the state's attorneys are reelected in 2020. Obviously, we have a presence in the legislature, so we're really taking sort of the model of the ACLU work and changing it. I think that we have found, both nationally and here in South Dakota, that since 2016, people want to get involved more. They don't want to just say, yeah, I support the ACLU. They want to come in and connect with us and have specific ways that they can help. So part of that, one of the things we're doing is we've been doing Pints in Politics events all over the state. We had one in Sioux Falls in the spring. We had one in Pierre. And to be honest, we were like, okay, we're really afraid no one's going to show up. We've never done an event in Pierre outside of the legislative session. I was thinking if we can get 15 people in a room, I will consider it a win. And we ended up having 50 there, which was unbelievable to me. I was blown away. Next week, we're going to Rapid City to do the same thing. We're working on what we're calling our Smart Justice Campaign Party Launch. We're hosting a launch party, as we're calling it, in Madison, South Dakota. And we're inviting people to host their own parties across the state. So we're putting together a kit to help people figure out how to do that and sort of use it.
And with the intent of having it like a house party or a restaurant
yes.
party, whatever.
Yes.
But
and we're
focusing the event around this discussion, around
yes.
smart justice and what we can do about incarceration.
Yep. And so we will we'll have a campaign briefing that'll be about 10 minutes. And we'll live stream that on Facebook so people can connect with that. And we've put together a discussion guide for people to talk about, you know, what are you seeing in your community? Here are the statistics on how mass incarceration or how incarceration generally has increased in South Dakota. Why do you think that is? Do these numbers surprise you? Right? Because we know that here in South Dakota, so in 1978, we housed about 500 inmates. Over the last 40 years, that number has increased by more than 700%. I think
Our population hasn't increased.
No, 700%. No, it has not. Our state's prison numbers have actually grown at a rate of about 30 times the state's overall population increased during the same period.
And it's always important to benchmark it from that.
Yes.
Because that's what makes sense of what is really more prisoners than we should
yeah.
have.
Yeah, and also to look at the numbers per capita, right? So we know that our incarceration rate in South Dakota is about 855 per every 100,000 people. Mm-hmm. That in a vacuum in and of itself doesn't really mean much. But when you compare it, that means that we in South Dakota have a rate higher than the national average, and we also comparatively, our rate is a lot higher than countries like El Salvador, Thailand, Cuba, Russia. Places like that that people think of as these horrible, you know, these horrible places, Russia, they must lock everyone up there. Turns out right here at home, we're doing it at a higher rate. And I think a lot of times those of us, in the Midwest and from the Midwest, you know, you hear stories about New York and California and, oh, their prison systems or their incarceration is out of control. We actually lock up people at a higher rate, and we need to deal with, we need to recognize it, deal with it, and figure out a way forward.
I'm thinking about now, like, you're going to be educating the public, and then I'm thinking about what they can turn to their local prosecutors, as well as, I guess, specifically this year to our attorney general candidates
mm-hmm.
to say, hey, we want you to do this.
Mm-hmm.
First off, with prosecutors, within existing law,
mm-hmm.
it's existing South Dakota law, what does the ACLU say prosecutors could do right now
mm-hmm.
that would help us deal with the problem more effectively and more holistically?
Prosecutors have a huge amount of discretion in their
Even
daily
now.
Lives. Even now, they can decide who to charge, what to charge them with, what their sentencing recommendations are, whether they're recommending bail or pretrial release. Every day in every single case that comes across their desk, they can choose to some extent the best way forward. And I think part of it is the simple fact of showing our local prosecutors and our attorney general that people are paying attention, right? And that we want to see a society and communities that are safe, but that also don't harshly punish people suffering from mental illness and addiction and all of that. And I think step one is paying attention and making it clear to our elected officials that we are paying attention. There was actually a really interesting race out of St. Louis County in Missouri. I don't know if you paid attention to that at all. The prosecutor there, who had been the prosecutor for something like 30 years, presided over everything that happened in Ferguson, didn't end up choosing to indict the man who shot Michael Brown. He just lost in his Democratic primary to a person who challenged him and said he was going to do things right and he was going to pay attention to racial injustice and he was going to make fair bail recommendations and all of that. And that was inside the Democratic Party, and that was just this week that he lost. And I think that, I don't mean that in a threatening way, you know, it's not, hey, prosecutors, you're on notice, but people are paying attention more now than they ever have, and we're really starting to see a national reckoning of recognizing the role prosecutors play in mass incarceration, and I hope we can do a version of that here in South Dakota.
And again, and that's local prosecutors. Mm-hmm. That's not even at the formal lawmaking or even writing new ordinances at your level.
Exactly.
That's just saying to prosecutors, you have alternatives
mm-hmm.
that could help people save money long term, whatever. It's just
Absolutely.
A matter of getting people focused
yep.
on that and away from the short term tough on crime
yeah.
message.
Yeah, and I mean, local prosecutors can decide if there are drug court programs in your community, like there are here in Minnehaha County, mm-hmm. the prosecutor can decide who to recommend for drug court and who to send to prison. That is in their discretion. That is their job to make that decision. And I think we can make it clear to them that we want more people in drug court and fewer people locked up.
And the drug courts have been working in South Dakota, right?
They have. Yeah, they have. I think, you know, I've met with people involved in that system and talked to some of the substance abuse counselors, and they have wonderful things to say. You know, it doesn't work 100% of the time, but we're finding that actually getting people treatment and keeping them in communities and connected to their families actually leads to better outcomes.
Yeah, well, and incarceration apparently doesn't work 100% of the time either.
Yeah,
out,
sure.
And they end up back in.
Exactly,
so, yeah,
exactly.
Perfection is not our goal here. Improvement's our goal.
Exactly.
Now, prosecutors apparently have lots of range to, you know, discretion to do the right thing mm-hmm. or do better things, seek better outcomes. In the Smart Justice campaign, are there laws you're looking at and saying, in addition, these are statutes we should change in South Dakota that would make a difference in incarceration?
Yes. One of the things we hate generally are mandatory minimums. We've always hated those, and that's, you know, that's been something we are communicating to candidates and to the public that they should ask the state to get rid of the mandatory minimums
that
exist.
What's the fundamental flaw in a mandatory minimum?
You're not giving the judge discretion in those cases to look at all of the universe of facts in front of them. You're saying that we as state legislators are deciding for you, the judge, in this individual circumstance, what kind of sentence you have to hand down. You know, I think it's funny because sometimes we put a lot of faith in judges unless the legislature doesn't want to. The other thing, one of the things that has been sort of on my radar for a long time is that ingestion law. I would absolutely love to see that reduced to misdemeanor levels. You know, it's kind of shocking to me that it hasn't happened yet when you look at the trends nationally, and especially, you know, this past year in the 2018 session, Senator Craig Kennedy out of Yankton brought a bill to do just that, to make ingestion a misdemeanor instead of a felony. And the Legislative Research Council put together their cost estimate, the prison population estimate, which they always do on those sorts of bills, and they found that South Dakota would save $61 million in state and county costs over 10 years if we made the simple change of making ingestion a misdemeanor instead of a felony.
Because that would be a whole class of basically drug users
mm-hmm.
who would not be going to prison.
Exactly, or wouldn't even be subjected to a felony term.
Right.
Right?
They'd get their ticket, they'd pay their fine,
mm-hmm.
and then hopefully we could still direct people to treatment in that context,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Once we see, oh, you've got a misdemeanor on this, that's
yeah.
$500,
yeah.
and you're going to go to some treatment.
Yeah. This is a little attenuated and a little outside of the Smart Justice universe, but back in 2015, I worked with then Senator Teason on a bill to change our felon voting laws. Right now in South Dakota, you can't vote, obviously, if you're physically incarcerated in prison, but you also can't vote while you are on parole and probation.
You have to have served your
entire
sentence.
Your entire sentence,
right.
Exactly.
Whatever the judge laid on you, you have to be done with.
Yep. So while you're on parole and probation, you're out in the community. You're living amongst, you know, society, if you will. But you can't vote. And so when we were working on that bill, obviously I came at it with a perspective of voting is good and democracy is great and we should expand the franchise and all of that. But I also came across research that showed that people who vote are less likely to commit crimes and recidivism rates are lower. So there was actually a public safety element to that. Of course, that bill didn't pass, but rarely they do on their first try. So I think that is an example of something really small the state could do that
it doesn't
could,
cost anything.
And it doesn't, yeah, exactly, it doesn't cost anything to
and
sort
like
of change the framing on it and change the way we're thinking about these things.
You said it's kind of attenuated, but even that idea of voting while on parole still mm-hmm. fits in the general idea of if we do more to connect people and reconnect people with what
mm-hmm.
matters,
mm-hmm.
their families, their jobs, their vote.
Yeah.
Rather than putting them in prison, kind of the ultimate separation from everything that matters to a person,
mm-hmm.
We get better outcomes.
Yeah, yeah.
And I would think that seems to resonate, because there's a feeling that, yeah, separating people from what matters to them is the hardest thing you can do
mm-hmm.
to a person.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to result in maybe worse outcomes.
Yeah.
Keep people connected with what matters, and they'll do what matters.
And then also, when you get down to it, what is our justification for preventing them from voting? It's all about punishment, right? You did a bad thing and we're gonna punish you, and even though you're out of prison now, we're gonna keep punishing you. And since you have a felony record, it's harder for you to find safe housing, because a lot of communities in South Dakota have what are called crime-free lease provisions, which is where landowners, renters sign up either with the city or, you know, sometimes it's police departments that administer these. But these crime-free leases say that a person with a felony can't live there. Right? So not only, you know, you get out, you've been in prison for X number of years, you're disconnected from your family, you're disconnected from your community, you can't vote, you have a hard time getting a job, you can't even find a safe and clean place to live. We're putting so many barriers in front of people once they've served their time and paid their debt to society, and then we're shocked when they reoffend. And it's just, sometimes to me, I have a hard time and I have to take a minute and be like, why are we doing this? Like, the system we have set up is not working, and it is unbelievable to me sometimes that we haven't tried something new, or that we can't get past our knee-jerk punishment being tough mentality.
Back to kind of where we started talking about, I guess specifically the Attorney General's race,
mm-hmm.
because that is the marquee race for talking about these issues. And
mm-hmm.
I've heard the candidates themselves on both sides talking about drug treatment and incarceration. I mean, it's obviously, you know, in their thoughts
mm-hmm.
already. Clearly, the ACLU is doing this as public education. The ACLU
yes.
is not saying, vote for this one, not that one.
Right.
But give us your picture of what an attorney general who believes in smart justice looks like.
Yeah, so we have put together what we're calling our platform, and what we think the attorney general candidates and eventually the attorney general should really focus on, sort of our beginning steps to what an attorney general should look like. We've actually put together a briefing book that we sent to all five candidates back before the primaries, and you know, both the major party candidates have these right now. So our platform, our first thing, reduce incarceration. What does that look like? We want an attorney general who is interested in expanding the use of alternatives to prison, whether we're talking about pretrial diversion, pre-arrest diversion, or things like drug courts and veterans courts. We want to see the next attorney general work to end the tough-on-crime approaches to drug users struggling with addiction, both in terms of sort of informal influence and supporting alternatives, but also supporting a repeal of our felony ingestion law and changing that to a misdemeanor. One of the big opponents to that bill this year was the Attorney General's office. That's a pretty hard thing to overcome when you're pitching a bill and the Attorney General comes in and says, don't do this.
Like you said, the Attorney General doesn't make law, but when the Attorney General walks into a committee room in the Capitol, that means something.
Yes, good luck trying to overcome that. The other major thing we're looking at is fairness and transparency and accountability. We want to see our next Attorney General work to eliminate racial disparities in our system. That starts with an acknowledgement of the overrepresentation of people of color, and we think that a good first step is to start collecting and publicizing data about the decision-making process, both on the Attorney General's office, you know, what are the charging decisions, what are the sentencing recommendations your office makes generally, what do you normally do in the plea bargain process, to put those policies together and make them publicly available so that we can start to look at where decisions are being made and where people are being shuttered either into prison or into alternatives. We also want the next Attorney General to really let the public judge their performance. Fully transparent practices allow the public to understand what's happening and decide for themselves whether that's what they support or they don't support. Going along kind of with the racial disparity and making that information public, there are a lot of, I don't know if you've visited the Attorney General's website recently, but it's really hard to find information on there. There's a lot of information that exists that is public information, but it's not accessible, right? So you need journalists or you need groups like the ACLU to file public records requests and hopefully get something useful. If it's public information and it helps people understand the system, it should be on your website and it should be accessible.
And it should be clear.
And it should be clear.
Tells people, we know what you need, we understand what you want to know. We're going to make it easier for,
yes,
you, for
yes.
you to find that.
And I think there are a lot of websites of our state government in South Dakota that could use a revamp from that perspective. Lastly, we really want the Attorney General to start recognizing that the people of South Dakota are their constituents. Right? We want them to engage with communities across South Dakota, not just with law enforcement and prosecutors and the occasional defense attorney, but to really come to the public and ask, what are you seeing in your communities, especially communities that are most impacted by crime, that might have high crime rates or a high incarceration rate. They really can't get a full picture of what the state needs and really what justice looks like without engaging with the people who are directly affected.
And you say you've sent these packets, this
yes.
information, to our Attorney General candidates. Any response yet?
Yeah, we've talked to one of them. We sat down, had a meeting. We've tried really hard to get the other one to sit down with us, but no response. We also put together a candidate questionnaire. It's the first time we've ever done something like that, so we sent that out. Wanted responses by the end of the day today.
Check your email.
I know, right? So one of the campaigns has responded and filled out that questionnaire, which is awesome.
And we'll get to see that at some
yes,
point.
Yes, yes.
Once both have had a chance.
Once they both had a chance, exactly.
ACLU will share those responses from the candidates.
Yes, yes. So we've got one. Hopefully we'll get the other in the next 20 minutes, because we think people should know where candidates stand on the issues. And the things we're asking are not outrageous leading questions, right? Some of the questions we had were, what would your top three priorities be as the Attorney General? How would you measure success, both of yourself as the Attorney General and your staff? Where do you stand on the adult and juvenile justice reforms? If you think they need to be changed, which parts would you like to see changed? Would you support drug courts, or do you support drug courts and veterans courts? Really basic stuff that people should know before they cast a vote.
Great. Smart Justice is a new public education campaign coming to us from the American Civil Liberties Union of South Dakota, which will be coming to a town near you.
Yes, absolutely.
Hosting house parties, asking folks to think about what we can do to put fewer people in prison and more people right with themselves and their communities, so we can maybe save some money and do what's right for everyone.
That's 100% it.
And we'll get some Attorney General responses on those questionnaires shortly, right?
Fingers crossed, yes.
Looking forward to it. Libby Screen, American Civil Liberties Union of South Dakota, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.